Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Elizabeth Goitein, the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, which seeks to advance effective national security policies that respect constitutional values and the rule of law. Previously, she was counsel to Senator Feingold, chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and her latest article at the Christian Science Monitor is The Danger of American Apathy in NSA Surveillance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Goitein.
Thanks very much.
And there's been quite a lot of activity on the Hill today with declassifying the Director of National Intelligence, declassified documents. Much of what is sort of being declassified appears to be trying to catch up to what's been leaked by Edward Snowden. But you've written about this in, a much more interesting and compelling context, and that is the extent to which we're witnessing around the world, and particularly in the Arab world, people dying for freedom. And you're arguing that little by little, Americans are allowing their government to chip away at the fortress of legal protections that people in less privileged societies, including multiple nations in the Arab world, are giving their lives to build. What's your sense of whether the American people are going to wake up to this cumulative effect of their rights being chipped away at?
Well, one of the points that I made in the op-ed is that I think half of Americans really have woken up and have realized that this is happening and are starting to push back. And I think that's why we're starting to see some legislative initiatives to curb surveillance powers. But there's half of the public that is quite willing to give up liberties in return for what they believe to be greater security. And I guess part of what I'm asking is that people set the bar a little bit higher for what the government has to show in terms of the security that's being provided and how effective that these programs are before being willing to give away these freedoms, because it is significant. It's not just a little incursion on our privacy. It's part of a pattern. And I think if people could take a step back and see the pattern, they might demand a little more evidence from the government before they gave up yet more liberty.
So I guess this very close vote in the House last week is a bellwether for the division in America?
I think that's exactly right. I think it's a bellwether for what's going to happen going forward. I think there will be a battle. I think the battle will play out in Congress as well as in the public sphere. And I think it's a fairly evenly pitched battle at this point. But I think that, you know, it's still early in terms of the American people actually having had time to understand and digest what's been going on. And I think that as revelations continue, and they are continuing, the picture will become clearer and people's viewpoints will crystallize. So I'm not trying to say that I think we're frozen in a position where half the country feels one way and half the country feels the other way. I don't think that's true. I think this is very much in flux.
But surely it's not an even or level playing field in the sense that it is civil libertarians and outraged citizens versus the political establishment, the intelligence establishment, the defense establishment. I mean, the patronizing attitude of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid that you mentioned in your article, Elizabeth Goitein, when confronted by the domestic spying of the NSA, his advice was, quoting, just calm down and understand that this isn't anything that is brand new. Well, a lot of people in the press had that attitude about Snowden. Oh, we've heard all this before, and therefore it's not important. I mean, extraordinary to me that that attitude is a way to deflect the importance of what is going on.
It's interesting because I think I actually used the word patronizing in my first draft and then at some point took it out. But that's exactly right. I mean, when I read that quote, when I heard that he had said this, my response was, wait a minute, it's not brand new? That's worse. I mean, if it's been going on for 7 years, that makes it worse, not better. You're right. There's not a level playing field. There's certainly an informational advantage that the government has. It knows a lot more, not only about its programs, but about any purported benefits that the programs have, because the government is in a position to make assertions about the benefit of these programs and then say, well, we can't really provide the details because they're classified. So that, you know, makes the playing field less level. That said, people in Congress want to hold office. They want to be reelected. If their constituents are upset and they are hearing from their constituents in a concerted way and people feel passionately enough about this, they will take notice and they will take action.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Goitein, the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. She has an article at the Christian Science Monitor, The Danger of American Apathy in NSA Surveillance. So what's the sense then of possible changes on the judicial branch? We've seen now on the legislative branch we had the vote that came in very close, and I guess at this point I'm not sure. I know there are a couple of senators on the Intelligence Committee who for the longest time have been hinting that things are there's far more going on than we know about. And I'm talking about Jeff Merkley and Udall. But on the judicial side, it was revealed recently that the Chief Justice John Roberts has basically appointed all of these extremely conservative judges on the FISA court. Is there any way to have a more representative FISA court that's less inclined towards national security and more inclined towards civil liberties?
I think there are proposals out there for changing the way the appointments process works. I don't know how much traction they'll get. I will say that I was very surprised to learn when I first learned that 10 out of the 11 judges had been appointed by either Bush, Reagan, or Bush. But then I was also surprised to learn, sort of following up on that, that the record of granting or denying surveillance requests actually had not shifted over time with the changing composition of the court, so that even when the court was much more evenly representative, its record was about the same.
Meaning that the preponderance of the government's bias is towards surveillance as opposed to civil liberties, isn't it? It's pretty heavily slanted in that direction, isn't it?
Well, what I was saying there was just that the record of the court in terms of granting the government's request for surveillance has been fairly consistent over time.
But isn't it about 90% or something, or 99%?
It's more than 99%.
That's the point I'm trying to make. Yeah.
It's enormous. I realize that I shouldn't be that surprised by the consistency, because national security is one of those areas where judges of all different ideologies that vote very differently or rule very differently on other issues tend to come together and support claims of national security, or I should say tend to defer to government claims of national security fairly uniformly. So the judges being inclined to defer to government claims of national security interests, to me, that is not a sign that we need more ideological diversity on the court. It's a sign that we need somebody else there arguing the other side in order to try to push back against the natural inclination to defer.
But the overall point that you're trying to make, Elizabeth Goitein, particularly in your article, The Christian Science Monitor, The Danger of American Apathy on NSA Surveillance, is the extent to which there has been a steady erosion and diminution of legal protection since 9/11, and that the choices really haven't been made, they haven't been debated, and that I guess the correlation of forces are that, you know, the government powers must be a matter of choice, not passive acquiescence to secret expansion. Now, that seems to have been what's happened in response to 9/11. Do you detect a sea change now? I mean, how can we correlate the restrictions on the Fourth Amendment, et cetera, and the massive amount of government data that's being gathered, and just this leak today that's in The Guardian, to one program, which is apparently a training slides of a program that Snowden released, indicates that they can process something like 40 billion pieces of data. So that's happening on the one hand, and then on the other hand, we end up with a couple of, as they were described by their uncle, losers in Boston with about $100 worth of material, shutting down an entire American city for a week. It turns out that they weren't a part of any great international network. And that's basically might well be the profile of the threats we're facing. So where does the proportionality come into this?
Mm-hmm.
We're spending $1 trillion on Homeland Security, and a couple of bozos for $100 can shut down an American city. In many ways, it starts to feel to me like this is what we do to ourselves, not what they do to us.
Right. Well, I think there are probably people out there who really are willing to give everything away in order to have 100% security from the possibility of a terrorist attack. But first of all, I think most people probably don't feel that way. I think most people understand that it's a balance and that there are other things that are important to them in terms of the exercise of their liberties. But then the other thing I would say is that you can't ever be 100% safe from a terrorist attack. I mean, that's just a fact. And there is no evidence that dragnet surveillance of Americans' data and information is the way to get closer to that point. I mean, if anything, there's some evidence in the other direction that really government agencies have been drowning in data and they haven't been able to make appropriate use of it because there's too much of it. So it's not... It's not a good trade-off.
Sure, but Elizabeth, if the reality is that we are a million times more vulnerable to slipping in the shower and hurting ourselves than we are to a terrorist attack, and I believe the statistics are pretty extraordinary on this. I mean, the chances of a terrorist attack are about equal to being visited by a UFO. So that's what I'm asking about, proportionality. The president's asked for a debate here. Isn't that a good place to start, about a cost-benefit analysis of what we're doing?
Absolutely. I mean, I think a cost-benefit analysis absolutely needs to be done, and I think that cost-benefit analysis is particularly critical because there really are some indications that not only that we're getting very small benefit in return for high cost, but that it may some of our policies may actually be counterproductive. And that if you really want to catch terrorists, then you need to focus in on the people whose behavior actually gives rise to some sort of suspicion of criminal activity, and that dragnet surveillance is just wasting resources and not moving you closer to the goal. So, yes, a cost-benefit analysis is most definitely in order.
And do you think that we'll learn more, Elizabeth Goitein? I mean, the leak that from The Guardian today on this program called X-Keyscore, which apparently is a training program. Snowden apparently released a bunch of slides. And the one that I was mentioning earlier said that nearly 42 billion records had been captured by the system during a one-month period in 2012. So it seems that we have created this extraordinary secret, what can we call it, the machine, and I've made this point to other people in the national security field. I asked them the simple question. During the Cold War, I worked on arms control with the Soviet Union, and one of the rackets of deterrence in those days was that there was never enough deterrence. So both sides were free to keep building planes, submarines, spending trillions of dollars on an endless pursuit of security, and that the more you built, the less secure you became. That was the paradox. Are we in a similar situation where in the information age, there's never enough information? So there's nothing to restrain the NSA and the taxpayer who funds it.
I think that's right. I think that is the situation we're in, and I think there is just an unquenchable thirst for more information in the national security community. And there are other parallels to the Cold War as well. You know, there were corporations that were making, you know, just incredible amounts of money off of the weapons system that we had back then. And there are private interests making a tremendous amount of money off the surveillance state. And so there are some very powerful, very wealthy interests that are going to be arrayed against reform, against right-sizing the national security establishment, and against curtailing some of these surveillance authorities.
So what do you think will be – we don't know what the fate of Edward Snowden will be, but he said that he wanted to start a debate, but then he ended up in the hands of the Chinese and the Russians, who are hardly interested in civil liberties. So it's a bit difficult to see how much his strategy has worked. On the other hand, as I mentioned, the president has called for a debate. Wouldn't you like to be in this debate? I mean, I'm ready to go.
I think a debate would be great. But we need to have the information to have the debate. I mean, even today, the documents that were released, I'm glad they were released. They're helpful. But the what's called a primary order, which is the FISA court's order to the government, saying what the government, what the restrictions are and how the government uses Americans' telephone records, that order had a classified appendix which explained when the government actually goes to query the data, what that means and what the government can do when it queries the data. And that appendix was not released. And that is really some of the most important information that we need to know. So we can't have a debate on that yet. And there are plenty of other things. I mean, you know, to the extent what we've read about X key score is accurate, that's something we need to have a debate about, and the government hasn't said anything about it. So it is very hard to have a debate without when only one party to the debate has the information.
Just in closing, though, Elizabeth Goitein, there is a sort of been a steady erosion of our protections under the Fourth Amendment, arguably under the Fifth Amendment, because there's so much information out there, a lot of which people willingly give to Google and Facebook, to the extent to which there's so much information about you out there that you could be incriminating yourself without knowing it. But just in terms of the erosion of the Fourth, you know, we have drones now with infrared that can look into your home. So, you know, the idea of you being secure in your person and your home and your papers under the Fourth Amendment, I mean, I don't believe it makes any sense to revive the Fourth Amendment to bring it in line with the 21st century so much as it makes more sense to make it robust and return to its intention. I mean, do you think that those that argue that we need to update it in the electronic age are really at the really saying that we should water it down as opposed to restore its robust fundamental nature?
Well, I suppose depending on where you're coming from, you could mean different things by saying it needs to be updated to grapple with the information age. What I would say is that some of the doctrines that came about under the Fourth Amendment were premised on certain assumptions about the presence or absence of certain technologies at the time. And that's unfortunate because what happened is that the technologies changed, and so the assumptions no longer hold true, and so the doctrines no longer make sense. So, for example, there's something called the public space doctrine, which means you have no expectation of privacy in what you do in public. But that was when, you know, somebody observing you in public might see what you do as you walk down the street, and that was it. We didn't have surveillance drones. We didn't have GPS tracking. We didn't have cell phone location information that enabled the government to put together a comprehensive picture of all of your movements outside of your home, potentially from cradle to grave. And obviously, you should have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that. So what we need, I would say, more than updating the Fourth Amendment, we need to make sure that we have a technology-neutral Fourth Amendment that will protect us regardless of changes in technology. And we don't have that right now.
Well, Elizabeth Goitein, I
actually have one more. Can I make one more point?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I made the point in my op-ed that right now we are still a relatively free country, certainly compared to a lot of other countries around the world. But I should say that in the early part of the Cold War, that was not the case. There were people whose careers were ruined and whose lives were ruined because they got on blacklists. And, you know, there were people who sort of lived under a cloud because of their political and ideological beliefs. And what happened is that when some of the abuses that happened by the government came to light in the 1970s, there was a response. And the response was to put in place a series of laws and policies that establish a kind of golden rule. And the golden rule was that intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies do not collect information on Americans unless they have a reason, unless there is some basis for suspicion of wrongdoing or some suspicion that the person is associated with a foreign power. And that golden rule served us very well for decades. And, you know, the 9/11 Commission found fault with a lot of government practices, but it never said we need to collect more information about Americans with less suspicion. And yet, since 9/11, that golden rule has just completely unraveled. And across just a range of laws and policies, it is now, the government is now able to collect information about Americans with little or sometimes no suspicion of wrongdoing. That should worry us. That should worry us very much, because it just reopens the door to some of the abuses that we saw, you know, in J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, and abuses by the CIA and the NSA during the early part of the Cold War.
Well, Elizabeth Goitein, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Goitein, who is the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, which seeks to advance effective national security policies that respect constitutional values and the rule of law. Previously, she was counsel to Senator Feingold, chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and her latest article at the Christian Science Monitor is The Danger of American Apathy on NSA Surveillance. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the president's grand bargain for the largely mythical middle class.